We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If I ventured in the slipstream.
This episode of Inside Golf Podcast is brought to you by RickRungood.com. All the stats, tools, and info that I'll be referencing on the podcast can be found over at RickRungood.com. It is the largest golf betting and fantasy golf statistical database on the internet. We've got Euro Tour stats, Korn Ferry Tour stats, Live, custom model generator. Rick has made a ton of improvements to that over the last couple of weeks. Plus all my premium articles, Slack channel, where you can reach me for any questions. So sign up today using promo code Andy so they know that I sent you. That is the important part, and we would love to have you as part of the team. All right, I also want to give a major shout out to a new partner of the podcast, and that is Par for Success. Have you ever wondered how you compare to other golfers your age? I know I have. Should you be swinging faster? Can you play without pain? What is your body even capable of at your age? These are all questions I'm reckoning with myself, as it appears that my body is already starting to break down in my late 20s. Now you can find out the answers to all of these questions in less than 5 minutes. Par for Success has the largest research database of over 6,000 golfers just like you, and is giving away the answers to these questions for free. Stop guessing. Go get the answers for free at parforsuccess.com/Andy. As a bonus for listening to this show, you can also receive a free Zoom consultation to go over your results and give you a clear path forward. This is put together by Golf Digest Top 50 Golf Fitness and Medical Experts. And over 90% of golfers have no idea how they compare. Do not be one of them. Get your answers for free at parforsuccess.com/Andy. Find out how you should be swinging, how to get rid of pain, and how to play forever your best golf ever for free at parforsuccess.com/Andy. All right. Coming up on this podcast, my good friend Rob G and I are breaking down the entire DraftKings slate for the Mayakoba. Pretty good tournament, actually, that I'm pretty excited for. So without further ado, let's bring on Rob. All right, Rob G is here. It's been a while, man. We were just catching up off air a little bit. Bunch of life changes, more so specifically for yourself. You've had a kid. We were talking about how, the kind of sleepless nights and, you know, having to wake up with the kid at 3 a.m. has actually kind of helped your DraftKings ability, at least somewhat. But we've got a fun event this week. You know, I haven't been super, super locked into the fall swing the way I normally would, but I'm excited to sit down and talk some Mayakoba with you today, my friend.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. It has been a minute, but always nice to get back in front of you. And I know you've been traveling so much, kind of living vicariously through you in your pictures, those trips just seem incredible. I do have to ask, I know you kind of already processed Bandon, but how bad did your feet hurt after Bandon?
You know, it is one of those experiences where during it, you don't really feel anything. Like you're walking easy 15,000 steps a day, probably closer to like 25, but you're so engaged in the golf that you don't really feel your body starting to ache. I got sick when I got home. Like I realized I was like, oh my gosh, I did not drink enough water on this trip whatsoever. My entire lower body is hurting. So it's kind of the type of thing where during it, you don't really feel it because you're so locked into the moment, but then you kind of pay for it a little bit after. Are you, is it on the periphery for you? I'm doing a ton of band and podcasts that I'm going to release over the off season, but is it something you're looking at? I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, I would think that's kind of on now, like the, especially within America, the Mount Rushmore. And so, yeah, it's a dream. And I don't know when, probably not anytime soon that I'll get out there just because with having a newborn.
Right.
But gosh, yeah, that's gets high. Maybe not. Maybe it is number one, but that's, you know, in the top five, definitely of places that I would. And it seems like a great golf trip. I mean, you seems like you had some good buddies there. It just seems like an awesome place.
The one thing I'll say about Bandon too, before we get into my Koba, I'm going to talk at length about this whole thing in a couple upcoming podcasts during the fall swing. It's really affordable. It's really doable. Really? And I think that's why the business model works. And I think that's why they continue to be so packed. But it's the type of thing that seems conceivable. Like it's a trip that you walk away from and say, man, like price wise, logistics wise, I could probably do this every other year for the rest of my life. Like I could definitely make room for doing this on a semi-regular basis for the rest of my life. He keeps it like pretty underpriced to the point where it's like, man, I feel like this should be more expensive. And one of the things I like about Bandon that you don't really get at a place like Pebble Beach is you don't ever really feel like you're surrounded by, you know, hotshot millionaire golfers there. I mean, it's a bunch of regular guys going on. I mean, we met guys from golf trips from Texas and Seattle, and like, it's a place that you can go with your golf trip every other year, conceivably financially. And I think that's what makes it so appealing. I mean, if you called up Bandon today, I don't think you'd be able to get in for like another full calendar year. So, I mean, they are booked off the charts. And I think part of the reason for that is Mike Kaiser has figured out like a very, very smart strategy of making it affordable enough to the point where you can kind of feel like if you're just a regular dude that you can really make this happen once a year, once every other year, which I think adds to the experience in my opinion.
Yeah, no doubt. And it seems, again, I've never been, so maybe you can speak more to it, but it seems a spiritual experience, and especially from, I know it's a lot easier to get to Oregon from LA where you're located the majority of the time. And so us East Coasters, it's a little bit more of a trek, but then it's a little bit off the beaten path. Like it's a little hard to get to from flying into, whether it's Eugene, I'm sure.
Eugene, which was not bad. Not bad. But yeah, it is. You're right. I mean, it's definitely not near a large metropolitan area.
But yeah, but that seems like part of the, you know, I guess the awe of it too. It's this pilgrimage that you're taking where that you're having shared meaning amongst your friends and your group. And by walking, you know, you're more connected to the land, and that land is, you know, I've seen the drone footage. It's just incredible. And it's, I'm sure, breathtaking, but then also walking adds a piece of mindfulness that you're just connected to here now in the moment. And so the focus is the land, the activity, what you're doing of golf, and then maybe who you're with. And that's just got to be great for somebody's soul.
Oh, it's the best. It is the type of place that you come back from and you're like, wow, I feel totally refreshed, totally recharged. My love of golf is at an all-time high. It's like a night, you know, if I imagine many people have felt a little bit downtrodden or tired of what the professional landscape has turned into with golf right now, with the explosion of LIV and how that has put our sport in just like a really objectively weird place, whether you're for or against LIV or whatever. I think like the one thing that we can all agree on is that golf is in just a really precarious, interesting spot right now, where I don't think anyone can really predict where it's going. And some of the stuff, you know, whether it's watching the Butterfield Bermuda or whether it's watching LIV, it's like some of it can leave kind of a taste in your mouth, you know? And so you come back from a place like Bandon and it's like, wow, my love of golf, my faith in the game is totally restored after being mm-hmm. at a place like this. It's a total palate cleanser. But to transition into this week, like I think it's for fall swing event goes, this is pretty solid, right? You know, we had a much stronger field last year. It was like an uncharacteristically strong field last year. I still think this one's like pretty solid. It mm-hmm. certainly has more intrigue than last week's Butterfield Bermuda. So how would you rate kind of your interest level in this tournament? First of all, would you say that you've been following the fall swing super closely? Does that maybe change this week for you? Do you have like a favorite fall swing event? Is this a course that you particularly feel like you're drawn to? What's kind of the excitement levels for the Mayakoba?
You know, I think as we start getting into November and maybe we realize there's not a lot of golf left before the little bit of like kind of the winter break. And then there's not a lot of good golf left. You know, you got to throw in, I think, the Houston Open and the RSM and the Hero and things like that. So, yeah, I'm excited. I know the CJ Cup is always good. And I'm glad, you know, is that Congaree. That's always just kind of cool to see. And so I didn't watch much golf last week. You know, we're recording this on Halloween and it just kind of fitting and it's kind of a dad joke, but you know, that's fitting because that was scary stuff yesterday. I did write up Ben Griffin on FanShare and that kind of, a poor guy, you know, didn't work out as well, but
it certainly did not. No,
no, but I gosh, that field, I can't remember a field maybe worse than that. And I'm sure there is, but yeah, now we get Scotty, Hovland, Victor, you know, Tony, a few studs, and it piques the interest. It's it's something to get up about. It's, you know, always gonna. I don't know about you, but you've been kind of hot on NFL. Your ROIs are pretty impressive. it's hard to follow both simultaneously, especially on Sunday. But I feel like this is one of those weeks where you can kind of make it happen.
Totally agree. And I watched the Butterfield last week, you know, solely because I had a big ticket on Ben Griffin. To be honest, I do not think that I would have made room. I'm a one screen guy. So, you know, I got to prioritize. I don't have the luxury of having multiple screens. I could kind of put something up on my laptop, but, mm-hmm. you know, for the big screen, it's usually NFL during the fall swing. But yeah, I think this event, I like this golf course. I'm not a huge fan of Greg Norman as a designer. I think that he tends to do some.
Are you a fan of Greg Norman in other ways?
I'm not. but as a designer, I think that he tends to rely on some more gimmicky stuff as opposed to mm-hmm. really using the natural land to kind of create interesting green complexes. I don't think that he's super talented at that, but what I do like about this golf course is it has a distinct character to me, right? And I think there are a lot of golf courses on the PGA Tour that don't really have a distinct character. And in my opinion, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the course as well, but to me, this is a real position A, position B golf course. Like this, you know, like the term coastal course gets thrown around a lot. This is not really a coastal course at all. You're maybe getting one or two holes that are exposed to the ocean. It's really not, you know, when I think coastal course, I think wind is a giant factor. It's really not that much of a factor at this course. I mean, a little bit, but mm-hmm. the course is pretty much framed by this giant mangrove jungle, right? Where you're you're weaving through this kind of dense jungle. You have canals kind of running through the property. You're kind of in this like enclosed space where, you know, if you hit the ball in the mangroves, you're dead on arrival, right? Like that's a penalty stroke. There's no hitting the green in regulation from there. So to me, this is a golf course that has a pretty specific personality, right? It has, it's asking you the question of, can you keep the ball in the fairway off the tee? Because if you cannot do that, if you cannot complete that essential step one, then you are somewhat dead on arrival. And I like golf courses like that because I think it gives you the ability to kind of create and shape and formulate a narrative around the way that you think this golf course is going to play and then kind of cater your DraftKings pool to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt. And I don't have your eye for the golf courses. That's something, one of the many kind of talents you have. And so I'm not going to say much because I don't think anybody listening wants me to, add to what you have. They just want me to shut up and listen to you. I think this is one of the shortest courses or top five on tour. And so just kind of reiterating that point, but I'm going to defer to your lens and your viewpoints on the course.
Yeah, it is one of the shortest on the PGA Tour schedule. I think it is a hair over 7,000 yards and plays as a par 71, right? So you're getting that extra par five in there and it's still only 7,000 yards. It's going to tip out to one of the shortest on the schedule. I think there's one par four over like 465 yards on the entire property. So you're getting this large plurality of short par fours. But I appreciate you saying that about my course knowledge, but I think you're selling yourself short a little bit, especially when it comes to DraftKings. And we'll get to the DraftKings pricing in a second here. But you were one of the first people that I followed on DraftKings that I really saw kind of talking about the things that I thought were personally important that didn't really get talked about enough in the industry, which is, spoiler alert, ownership. And so I've probably gotten, I think the last time you were on the podcast, about at least 6 months, maybe closer to a year, definitely got some new viewers. So maybe just quickly before we get into the DraftKings, maybe give a little background on kind of your history with DraftKings and how you've honestly had one of the more successful stories of people that I know in terms of actually winning money and not just kind of talking about it, that I know, at least in the Twitter space.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. So I guess it's the last 5 or 6 years have had an ROI positively within PGA DFS. At the end of every year I post, there's this thing out there called Roto Tracker, I believe it's called, that kind of you upload your entries. It shows your ROI, how your success rate. I post it every year. And last 2 years, 3 years really have been successful. And they come in different ways, whether it's winning a GPP. And I'm not, I know like Tambo and some of the great, Tony out there, some of the greats. My goal is to win six figures in one event. That hasn't happened. Has won 50K, won in the 20s a couple of times. And that obviously helps, especially I'm a GPP player. And so it's just about withstanding the, what tends to happen in GPPs is that you can lose, if you're playing for, let's just say, a year, you can lose 12 months or 11 months out of the year, And then you have that 1 month where you might take down a GPP and it just sends your ROI just kind of skyrocketing. But this past year has been kind of different where there was a 2 month period this summer. It was almost like every other week I was winning 10K here, 5K here, 4K, 10K. And it was a little bit more consistent in the meat of the summer. Didn't win. I won a smaller showdowns kind of GPPs, but it was finishing top five pretty consistently. And that really helped the ROI. It wasn't as high as last year. So I think last year was around like 30 and now this is like 18 or 19. As of right now, but it was just interesting how that switch. I guess that shows that there's many ways to be successful at this. But one way I started just with having a small presence on like within the golf Twitter community is, this was before, your show, Brian's show. I was just listening to these kind of the talking heads at the time. And they were going over DraftKings plays and talking about salary and nobody. And I was talking about game theory, and I'm not saying that I invented it. I'm not saying that I came up with it or anything, because people, professionals, have been using it long before I have, but nobody was just, you know, saying it. It got me thinking that, gosh, if people really want to be successful about this, they need to kind of consider it. That was my viewpoint, and went into about how to maybe use ownership in a, I'm a therapist, so maybe it's the wrong lingo, but a healthy way. I'm sure there's a productive, I don't know what else to say, but yeah, a healthy way, because what tends to really happen, especially I see it now and or with new players, is that we hear the term contrarian and we think of ownerships and a week where chalk hits, and then we just kind of abandon the strategy. Maybe a perfect example is last week in NFL. And I know I'm jumping around, but last week was, I think, in NFL, the most chalkiest week to hit in NFL. And it's kind of been like that throughout.
Was it really? I don't play NFL DFS, but I'm always curious to hear, because I have a lot of friends that are in the space. It was one of those weeks.
It was probably the most chalkiest I've ever seen. First, you had around 60% Tony Pollard score 3 touchdowns, and that was kind of a theme. And so when that happens, people think, well, that contrarian stuff maybe doesn't work, and they abandon their strategy and they get so inconsistent. And game theory is a lot of ways, but one way specifically related to this is saying that, okay, I can't take things so week by week, or I say living paycheck to paycheck. You have to kind of zoom out, because the real game is not fully just picking golfers against the salary and you're just making the best lineup. The real game is finding leverage against your other lineups you're competing against in your tournament. And how you do that is consistently find, and you kind of do it so well, salary versus ownership. You know, what leverage does that create, and how can you highlight on that? And what I'm really doing this fall swing is even leaning into that game theory more and taking pretty kind of wild stands. And what I mean by that, if I'm making 150 lineups, I might have 100% of a golfer who's in the 7K and 2%. And the majority, 95% of the weeks, I could be busted by Thursday eve or Friday evening.
Yeah.
But in that one opportunity where that golfer might smash, and it may only come one tournament a year, it gives me the best opportunity to win a GPP, which is what your goal should be, playing GPPs. Long-winded, but that's the short of it, I guess.
I could talk game theory with you all day too, because I know, I agree. You were one of the reasons why I was drawn to you and we were able to become friends a while ago, was you were one of, like you just outlined, one of the people that was like, hey, how are we talking about DraftKings, but not talking about this? Like, it was basically a thing for a long time in terms of content, where people were treating DraftKings slates like they were betting shows, where were talking about DraftKings pricing and DraftKings plays as if you were playing against the books. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, do you get what I'm saying there?
It was we were
doing DraftKings shows and talking about them like they were betting shows. Right. And I talk about betting and I talk about DraftKings, and it's like, yo, the guys that I like for betting could be far different than the guys that I like for DraftKings. Right. You've got to realize you're playing different games. In betting, you're playing against the books. In DraftKings, you're playing against other people, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this whole other psychology behind it that you need to consider. Let's dive right into the pricing. So we're recording this pretty early on Monday afternoon. So I don't know if any ownership projections have come out. I know that ours on Rick Run Good usually come out later in Monday evening. So we'll probably do our best guess to do some guessing and projecting of ourselves. But I'm looking at the 10K range here. Scheffler's the highest priced player at 11.4. Then you have Victor Hovland, 2-time defending champion, 11.2. Morikawa, 10.6. Finau, 10.4. Aaron Wise, 10.2. Billy Horschel, 10. I'm going to give you a two-part question here, Rob. Part A is, who do you expect to be the chalk in this range? And part B is, who is the guy that you probably have most interest in yourself personally?
Yeah, that's really tricky. And so I maybe answer the second question first, and that's Colin Morikawa was extremely high on him at the CJ Cup, finished 29th, but just struck the ball incredibly well. And I
vintage
think
vintage Morikawa
see,
ball striking, right?
Exactly.
And totally vintage, yeah.
Yeah, and we're going to see positive regression from him. You know, look, he finished fifth in the Masters, fifth in the U.S. Open. But I think he, and second at the Genesis, I think he would even consider, though, going winless last year of a disappointment. I think we see Morikawa respond in this new season and going into kind of next year, really. And the ball striking's there. Now, he has lost over six strokes on the, you know, on the greens. But that's Morikawa. It just comes with the territory. But I have a hard time getting off on one because I just mentioned I think we see positive regression. But also he, at the CJ Cup, he was one of the lower owned in the price range, a little bit more talented field there than here. But over the last 24 rounds, he ranked second on approach, fourth in ball striking, 11th from, I think, a key proximity range, which is 75 to 100 yards. And just total proximity, he ranks second. So it's hard to get away from Morikawa. If he didn't model that well, I would say he would be kind of low owned and people might obviously lean to Scotty the victor. But what tends to happen, everyone has the same information. And I think maybe even Colin now might become one of the highest owned in this range. What do you think?
No, I agree with you. I think that there is going to be a lot of overthinking here and trying to be sneaky, which is what you start to see a lot in the 10K range, where everybody thinks that Hovland is going to be the play. He's a two-time defending champion. What's not to like about Victor Hovland? And then they say to themselves, okay, the obvious play is Hovland, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go $600 cheaper and take the discount on Morikawa, who, like you said, models out really well. Is just anybody who looks at the ball striking numbers is going to see that he really appears, the arrow at we at least can agree on is pointing up, right? And you brought up the putting concerns. He did lose six at the CJ Cup, which is like aggressively bad. But before Colin won, I believe it was the concession. So a little over a year ago when he won the concession, he lost eight strokes putting in the start directly prior to winning the concessions, right? So we have seen Morikawa turn the putter around really, really quickly. I'm with you. I think that ownership will be, I don't think between this big four, right? And I think we can say the big four are Scheffler, Hovland, Morikawa, and Finau. I don't think that one player will emerge as 30%, right? I don't see that. I think there's enough parity between those four. Finau was number one in my model. There's a ton of great things we could say about Finau. Scotty Scheffler obviously is still, the second ranked player in the world. So I think that range, not one overwhelming chalk is going to emerge. I think some people would think that would maybe be Hovland. I don't think that there will be a massive discernible difference between Hovland and the other guys. What's interesting is once you get lower, right, which is Aaron Wise is 10.2. Now, I think if Aaron Wise was 9.7, I think he would maybe be the highest owned player on the slate. But now that he is priced up and he's 20-1 in the betting market, so no one's going to bet Aaron Wise at 20-1 either, right? The fact that Wise is priced up that much and there's a $200 difference between Wise and Finau, and I think most people would agree that Finau is better than $200 more expensive than Wise. I think that the bottom of this range is where you might start to see a little bit of opportunity with Wise and Horschel.
Yeah, no doubt. And speaking of Horschel, I have no idea why Wise is $200 more than him.
Makes no sense to me either.
It does. Wise beat him by one position point at the CJ Cup. He finished sixth. Horschel finished seventh, but Horschel won the Memorial. And funny enough, Wise, I think finished second to him at the Memorial. But Billy is in better form, as better back class. And as the model out much better than Wise, it's just kind of fascinating. But I think you're right that Wise may even be more popular than Billy. And I just want to say this. Let's just say that Billy is 10% and Wise is 24%.
Yeah.
Don't think it'll be that huge, but let's just pretend it is. What people make a huge mistake is let's just say then Billy Horschel misses the cut. We tout Billy Horschel. He misses the cut this week and Wise goes on the finish, let's say like in the top 10. Mm-hmm. People say, oh my gosh, Billy Horschel was a bad play. Why did I even include him in my player pool? There is so much. Please remember this. You have a lot of good listeners. Remember that there is so much variance in golf that to really understand a bad or good play, they would have to play the tournament 100 times in similar conditions to see if someone was an actual good play or bad play. There's that much variance in golf. So do not have a process and you identify a golfer that might be one of your favorite plays and he bounces and think that was a bad play. Maybe, but there's so much variance that you cannot abandon that. And I see so many people complain and share that on Twitter. And just because the player MCs does not mean it was a bad play, and do not then abandon the strategy. But I'm curious now in the 9K, because there's guys who are modeling out well. They don't have the name recognition. And then there's some deep back class guys that I really like that maybe are going to make a return. Speaking of positive regression, but what do you like maybe down in the 9K?
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
I really like Tom Hoagie. I don't know how popular he's going to be, Rob. I think that he is expensive. Although the guys below him, I don't know if you could make a case that any of the guys really below him should be more expensive than Tom Hoagie based on the way that Hoagie's been playing. But I still think a $9,500 price tag, he's what, the eighth highest priced player in this field. Like, I still think people are going to say, Tom Hoagie, $9,500. I just think that this is a guy that has a specific skill set that is going to make him a shit ton of money on the PGA Tour for many years. Tom Hoagie is statistically one of the best wedge players in the world over like a 2-year sample size that has not decreased since he won at Pebble Beach, right? He's on this nice little run now where he's finished top 15, like 4 strokes in a row. Like, as long as Tom Hoagie remains a top 5 wedge player in the world, like, he's going to have a very long career on the PGA Tour. Don't know how much he's going to win, but I think it increases his floor a lot because he is dependent on a skill set that tends to be very, very important week in and week out on the PGA Tour. There are a couple courses, Torrey Pines, Bay Hill, some of the major championships where wedge play isn't important, but I break these courses down every single week. 80% of the courses, Rob, you're going to have like 40, 50% wedges And Tom Hoge is so elite at this particular skill set. And I think this is one of those courses where it matters. So I'm pretty big on Hoge. I can't buy Taylor Montgomery. I just, listen, if you've been riding the guy, he's gained like 19 strokes putting in four events this year. Yeah. Keep playing him by all means. I'm not hopping on now. He's the best player in the world, best putter in the world this year. He's like passed Cam Smith over the last month as the best putter in the world. Like, I can't, I've never made money chasing putting. I'm not going to start now. So for me, probably Hoge would be the guy in this range that I care most about. And then I want to ask you about Griot too, because I think Griot would be my selection for the most popular player in this range.
Yeah, I agree with you on Griot, and to kind of back you on Hoge. So, you know, I guess not surprised, but when you see all the low numbers next to his statistics, it does kind of rattle you a little bit, because it, you know, it's Hoge. I mean, he's on a credible run right now. And yeah, he's won at Pebble Beach and he played well last year, but gosh, he ranks first on approach, third in ball striking, second in proximity. You're speaking of the wedges from 100 to 125, yeah. Fourth in proximity alone. If you were just kind of hiding the names, you might think, gosh, that's like Scotty Scheffler, I would bet. But no, it's Tom Hoge. And like we were saying with Colin, everybody is going to see that. And so then here's my kind of attitude. If Hoge is going to be pretty chalky, I might just say, regardless of everything, I'm just going to fade him and keep him out of my player pool. But there's no denying of how well he is playing. A guy I really like is Brendan Todd. Yeah. I do not think he'll be highly owned at all. He played really well at the Fortinet, you know, missed the cut at the Sanderson's Farms, but he played exceptionally well, specifically on approach at the CJ Cup, a course. Now, it was really dry, but a course we wouldn't think, you know, maybe best suited him. But gained seven strokes on approach. So, our, you know, kind of trending in that wet way we like to use. And using just a cumulative numbers of ball striking and approach, just simply ball striking stats, Brendan Todd's trending in the right way. He went from, you know, last 23 or 24 to 50 rounds being some of the worst in the field, and last 12 being ranking 33rd, last eight ranking 19, and then last four ranking fifth. That's a nice progression that maybe we're heading for a peak ball striking performance from Brendan Todd. I would expect he's around 8, 9, 10%, and the guy hasn't lost strokes putting since May of last year. So that's pretty consistent. He's always been a good putter, good on Bermuda, good, you know, I guess past Palom. I don't, but what surface do we got this week?
We got past Palom. Yeah. And you know, putting statistics with past Palom can be a little tricky, right? Because you get it at courses like Corrales and here where we don't have shot tracker. But yeah, Todd has proven, I mean, he's won this event before. So he definitely has proven that he can putt on past Palom, right? Past Palom is, it's about personal preference, right? I mean, we could argue till we're blue in the face whether past Palom's easier or harder to putt on. But the reality of the situation is you're just looking for players that have shown that they have raised their baseline on past Palom. And Brendan Todd has done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get your opinion. I know, unless anything you have in the 9K range, but I do want to skip down and just make sure we mention in the 8K, and that's someone who has quite a bit of history in Mexico, and not all good, but someone who's actually found some form and found some life. And that's the bottom of the 8K range, and that's Matt Kuchar.
Love him. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
We love him. I forgot what podcast. As soon as you mentioned that name, I remember that there was a tournament where we were both super high on Matt Kuchar. I have no memory whether that ended up working out for us, but yeah, 100%, dude. I love Matt Kuchar this week. I don't think he's dead. Like, I don't think that at 42 years old, he's incapable of winning at the PGA Tour level. He has flashed some upside. I mean, this is a guy that, you know, has finished in the top five in multiple PGA Tour events over the past year, some with better fields than this. And I just think that this is one of those courses. I mean, he's won here before in 2018, so yeah, pretty easy to make an argument in terms of course fit. But I think these are, this is one of the courses where you can feel pretty comfortable about rolling out Matt Kuchar. There are certain courses where I think he's going to be really behind the eight ball just based on how short he hits it these days. I do not think that this course is one of them. So I am totally in on Kuchar. Do you think he'll be popular this week? Do you think we need to worry about popularity with him this week at 8K?
8K kind of with the history, and people are seeing maybe how well he's playing, but I don't think, you know, he's going to be 20%, maybe not even 15%, but he'll carry some ownership. I'm just looking who's around him, and really nobody, which is kind of disappointing. So maybe people do land on him. I have some interest in Killa Keith above him. But yeah, those are the guys in the 8K range, and Brian Harman, maybe Casey. Yeah, yeah, that I have.
What do we do with Russell Henley? Because he's another guy that if you're making the case for Hoagie, right, which I am doing, then pretty much that everything that Hoagie does well, Russell Henley does well too, right? So it's difficult to sit here. There's still this like weird stigma with Russell Henley where he's just, it seems like he always freaking kills you, right? Like I feel like the fantasy and betting space has this love-hate relationship with Russell Henley. And there are certain weeks where Russell Henley is 18 to 1 on the betting board and $9,600. And it's like, you're really going to bet Russell Henley at 20 to 1. This is not one of those weeks. I think this is one of those weeks where I think he's 60 to 1 in the betting market. And I actually think that he is. Like, let me ask you a question. Would you blink if Russell Henley and Brendan Todd's prices were reversed? Or if even Russell Henley or Jason Day's prices were reversed at 9,200, right? Like,
I wouldn't even think anything of it. Now it's pretty, you know, it's pretty shocking when you first look at the board and you see Russell Henley next to Alex Noren and, you know, Andrew Putnam and 8,200 or 8,400, excuse me. But Russell Henley is a model oddity. He pretty consistently ranks in every single tournament that he's in pretty high in ball striking and approach and proximity numbers. It's just wild, but his results don't show anything. He's had one top five, two top 10 since the beginning of last year, but yet every single tournament he models that well. He's so frustrating. And he came on tour, won his first tour event, and everyone thought, you know, he was, you know, going to be so great. And he had a great first putting season, and that's letting him down. But man, Russell Henley, I think he is the DFS modelers. It's your nightmare.
Which I am one of. That is why card carrying member, for better or worse, of that category, where I get blinded by the stats sometimes. I haven't made a judgment call on him yet. I like Brian. Last guy I want to mention in this range before we go into the 7K range, I like Brian Harman a lot. I was prepared to play Brian Harman in the low nines this week when I made my pricing on Sunday, and I will happily play Brian Harman at 8.9K. I don't think he'll be uber popular this week. He makes sense, and I don't think he's going to be sneaking up on anybody. I think that anybody who's looking at numbers are going to say, this is probably a course where Brian Harman might be a good idea. But I still think with Dietrich right below him, I still think people are just going to, Dietrich has this like betting bandwagon that I don't think is really going to slow down, even though I would make the argument that this is a course that probably takes away his biggest weapon. So I like Brian Harman a lot at 8.9. Anything else you want to mention before we dive into the sevens?
No, sir.
All right, let's dive into the sevens. So there are a lot of players that I like in this range. I mean, it's a full field event, so you're getting a pretty juicy 7K range. I think that I have nine players highlighted in this range. I'm probably going to whittle that down to five by the end of the week, but I guess we'll kick it to you first. Anyone kind of in this top tier from like 7.5 to 8 that really has your attention?
Aaron Rye. He just disappointed me with going last week at the Butterfield Bermuda. But the ball strikers, there's something like, you know, Lee Hodges, the who am I looking at? The Hubbards, the Hayden Buckleys, all the ball strikers are always going to pop. But I do got to give a shout out to my boy D Flowers. My pick to win last week, and I told him he was going to win. I guaranteed it. Was Patrick Rogers? He finished third.
He was in the mix. Yeah,
he was. He was. I picked him to win. He plays well. Speaking of coastal courses, I know this isn't, but courses like Butterfield, Bermuda, or Corrales, or anything, he plays well at those events. But I have a rule now that I put in play the last couple of years. If I'm really, really high on a guy, so I'm really high. I was really high on Rye and Rogers last week. I have a rule that I have to include him in the player pool the following weeks, because what seems to happen is I'm a week too early on a guy, even though the field, the course is very different. I seem to be 1 week too early on the guy. So I am still, and I wouldn't, if you haven't played Rogers, I would not recommend it. It's just a totally, he is not good with the wedges. He's just bad, but I just have a rule and it says keep playing Rogers and I'm going to go ride with it. He did finish third last week. Hope he found something, but take it with a grain of salt, because he does always seems to play well on those type of coastal courses.
Well, how many DFS players fall into that recency bias, right? Where it's like, and I know this is a bit of a bet at this point, and a lot of people that use this term are using it in jest. But the whole idea of a blacklist is just something, for better or worse, I've never quite been able to understood. And I don't think is a worthy strategy if you're serious about winning money in DFS. I think you almost have to like operate under the inverse of that, where it's like you have such a short-term memory loss and you do not believe in the concept of a blacklist whatsoever, where you're actually willing to go back to players that maybe let you down last week. Look, I'm with you on Aaron Rye. I was pretty heavy on Aaron Rye last week. He was the headline selection for my Rick article on Wednesday. I had him in like 70% of my lineups at 10.1, I think he was last week. And he finished T50th, right? Didn't kill me, but didn't really get it done either. Like, if you're heavy on Aaron Rye last week at 10.1 and he finishes T50, how are you not going to play him at 7.5 and like probably low ownership? Like, how do you justify that in your head? Right. And so I'm totally with you on Rye. I'm going right back to him.
Yeah. And I was just going to say real quickly that if you do take blacklist seriously, I know many don't, but if you do, and I know for a fact there's some of you all or some out there that do, you're likely getting out of your skis a little bit with how much money you're investing each week, because if it comes that personal,
right,
and that means you're probably losing too much, and so that you scale it back. But yeah, it's easier to have a quick memory if you don't feel like everything is on the line. So make sure you're investing what you can afford.
Totally agree. A couple guys diving down a little bit lower. I am a weird sucker for Justin Rose. I don't know what the hell it is with me and this guy, but at 7,300, I'm going to play the upside here.
My major champion in this field at 7,300.
There we go. 7,300 major champion. He's still, I think there's still some statistical reasons to like him. I think that his skill set over a large sample size is conducive to this type of golf course. We just haven't seen him since the end of last year would be the big concern. But a couple of guys that I think are going to be really popular down here, Rob, Joel Damon, I bet you catches a lot of steam. This is just a Joel Damon course. And trust me, I get it. Like, if by some chance Joel Damon's in the single digits, then I'll be there too. But I have a sneaking suspicion that Joel Damon at 7,200 is going to be the, you guys notice Joel Damon past Palom, like he just strikes me as the guy that is going to be one of the higher owned players in this range. And then Russell Knox too.
I love Russell Knox
with the course history. I think maybe his kind of ho-hum finish last week is really going to help us a little bit. I think that if Russell Knox finishes top 25 or top 10 in last week's field, then this is a guy that's probably 7,600 and double digits. We might catch a little bit of a break on him at 71, but still the guys that I really like in this range, Rose, I'm a big Kevin Streelman fan. I gotta see it.
He'll be popular, I think.
You think so, Streelman? Well, why do you say that?
So look, over his last 24 rounds, people model chase. You're ranked sixth in ball striking, 14th on approach, third in total proximity. And that's great numbers from a guy, golfer 7,100. Unfortunately, if you look further, the form doesn't show as, you know, he finished 74th at Zozo, like near last, lost 11 and a half. Lost strokes on approach in the Shriners, lost strokes on approach to the Fortinet. I think his model numbers that people will just see are a little bit inflated. And so maybe I'm kind of just talking myself into a fade, but I like him. There's two guys I really appreciate. That's Justin Suh and Matt Wallace.
Yep. Big time on Suh this week. All over it.
And I don't think either of those guys are going to be that popular, especially Wallace. Nobody seems to like to play him. But at 7,100 and a guy good with the wedges, not in the best form, but you know, he's played well. I was really high on him at the Shriners. 28, not going to kill you, but hey, if a guy's near the bottom of the 7K that finishes top 20, that's not nothing.
Right. Last guy, I'm huge on Suh as well. I love him this week. Last guy I'll mention before we start talking about some sickos down here in the 6K range. Mm-hmm. I was really heavy on Will Gordon last week at 8,700. I don't think that I was alone on that. I think that Will Gordon was somewhere around like 13, 14% last week. Listen, if you played Will Gordon at 8,700, 13, 14%, and you were quote unquote disappointed with his, T40 last week, stick around for one more week at 7K. Just stick around for, I'm just telling you right now, like stick around for one more week at 7K. If Will Gordon was prominently featured in your player pool last week at 8,700, and now you're getting him at 7K because he had a bad Sunday and finished T40, that's dumb, DraftKings. If you're out after that, but that's all I got in the sevens. You want to kick us off in the sixes here?
Yeah, I'm going to shout out our boy Icarito on the NLU guy. Chez Fest this week.
Yeah, yeah.
I really like Chez, but a guy who burned a lot of people last week, missed the cut. I wrote him up, but that's Callum Tarran, 6,700, going right back to the well, probably at a severe ownership discount, definitely a severe salary discount.
1,500 salary discount. He was 8,200 last week and 15-16%.
Yeah. I mean, and so people are, again, if you have that, you know, blacklist mentality, if it burned you, if you went out of your skis, you're going to avoid them. But I think you go right back to them. The other guy I like is Miss Lipsky, David Lipsky. He hasn't in the best form, but over the last 24 rounds, good with the wedges, proximity from 100 to 125, he ranks eighth, approach 27th, ball striking 22nd. That's great numbers for a guy in a 6K range. So David Lipsky is the other guy I like down here.
Love Lipsky. I'll throw out CT Pan at 6,800. Mm-hmm. I'm a big CT Pan guy. I bet CT Pan at 180-1. Like I think this guy's underpriced, in my opinion. I think that CT Pan should be in the low 7K range. He was rock solid last week. He was, I think he finished top 20. He was heavily featured for me last week. I think this is another golf course that plays right into his hands in terms of the things that CT Pan does well, whether it's short iron play, whether it's driving accuracy. He's actually had some okay finishes at this course before. So I'm big on CT Pan. Lucas Glover is another guy that was pretty prominently featured for me last week at 7,500 that, you know, finished T60 and now he's 6,700. And again, like the reasons why we like a guy like Tom Hoagie or Russell Henley on this course, Lucas Glover does those things really well too. He's just not as good of a putter. I think at 6,700, I'll go right back to Lucas Glover. And then like, you know, Ryan Armour and Tyler Duncan are the classic, like, better stats than results guys that are probably going to show up as giant values in your model and then finish like T50. I don't know if I see the upside with those guys. Like, for me, I'm looking more in this range. Like, can this guy win? I think David Lipsky can win this tournament. I think Lucas Glover, who won the John Deere, can win this tournament. I think CT Pan, yeah, who won the Heritage, can win this tournament. I don't see Ryan Armour or Tyler Duncan raising the trophy. But do you see anyone in this range? That one thing I've noticed with the fall swing, at least, that I've kind of enjoyed is you haven't seen any like super gross 6K chalk emerge, I've noticed over the last couple of weeks. And maybe that's like a positive trend in the industry going forward, that people are just kind of understanding, like, yo, let's not conglomerate with a groupthink mentality around one of these 6K guys. But do you think any guy in this range is kind of like grossly mispriced, or you see some giant ownership potential with?
No, I do like your comparison that CT Pan should be, you know, in the low 7K range. So he's probably underpriced. Outside of that, I don't think there's any standout ownership wise. You know, maybe that David Lingmuir should get a little bit of a look after he kind of had a little bit of a resurgence. When was it? I mean, he played the U.S. Open. Made a couple cuts, but last week at the Bermuda finished 11th. And a guy who's been known, he's a short little guy, not a big hitter, can hit it well with the wedges. But outside of that, I don't think anyone's going to be super chalky. But I like your CT Pan call. Someone maybe who's mispriced.
I don't think I have anyone else. I mean, Paul Haley, I like at 6,500. But yeah, is there any guys that you want to give a quick shout out to before we wrap up? I think I've covered all of the names that I wanted to get to.
I think so, man. Me too. I think I kind of said everybody that might need to be said, and kind of this got me excited, looking forward to a decent field and maybe one of the last decent fields of the calendar year.
Could be. I think Houston might be good too. Did you make any bets, Rob? Any outright bets you want to give mention to before we sign off here?
No, but I haven't looked at the card yet, and I'm not one to, you know, I probably should, because you can get good numbers earlier in the week. But if Russell Henley is at 60-1, like you said, I'm probably going to definitely have to play that one. And so that I'll probably book that when we get off.
Yeah.
Shout out the jurors. But yeah, other than that, no. But we'll see what happens come Wednesday night.
Last question before we get out of here. Did you watch episode one, Torosaw Scandinavia?
I did. And I can't wait till the next one comes out on Wednesday.
On Wednesday. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love the golf, but I love how they're taking more of a maybe an influence on the tourist aspect in a place like Scandinavia and Sweden. Yeah, you wouldn't think to go golf, but just seeing the culture and those guys are so warm and welcoming, and the people they surround themselves with, it's so enjoyable. So yes, I have, and I loved it.
I'm with you. I was a giant smile on my face throughout that entire episode.
Well, let me ask you real quick before we go, Andy. Do you think that they'll come back after what happened the last episode of Strap South Carolina? Do you think they come back and they do another Strap?
Honestly, it was the kind of episode where it's like, if that's the final Strapped ever, man, what a fun one to go out on.
Yeah.
But I think they will. I think it's too popular of a series for them to ride off silently into the night, even though that episode would be kind of like the perfect capstone to the series. But yeah, I think they'll probably be back. I hope they're back. It's tough for me. What would you say you enjoy more, Torosaw or Strapped? I go back and forth on this one.
Yeah, it really depends. And this is such a cheap answer, but it really depends on the episode. So like where they're at.
That's the right answer. Yeah. It's fair. Mm-hmm. It's a cop out, but it's the right answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I appreciate that. All right, Andy. Well, I appreciate your time this night, this Halloween night. Thanks for having me on.
You got it, buddy. Real quick before we get out of here, do you have anything else to plug or anything you got going on this week that you want the listeners to check out? What happened to The Approach, man? That was like one of my favorite podcasts. It's just gone.
Yeah, well, we kind of put a pause on that. Having a baby, it's having the time to do all that, because just like you, and you probably put a lot, you probably work a lot harder. Probably you do. You work a lot harder than I do at this, but it still was a lot of work putting that on and running my own business and then a baby. It's hard having time, but I miss the community. I miss Drew. I miss everyone interacting. People are so kind to randomly check in, but maybe we bring it back to Kapalua to start the new calendar year. But it's been nice just to be a fan and listen to yours, and I still check in with Brian's and a few others. So it's nice to kind of be a little quiet and just be a fan.
All right. Well, I hope you guys come back maybe at least in January. I enjoyed that podcast, and as you know, I'm pretty picky with my taste with the stuff that comes out in this little industry, and I was always a big fan of The Approach, so I hope that you guys bring it back. Until then, Rob, it was good to see you, my friend. We'll do it again soon.
Sounds good.
All right, that is it for the podcast. Special thanks to Rob G, special thanks to rickrungate.com, special thanks to Par for Success, and we will be back next week breaking down the Houston Open, I think. Until then, best of luck with your bets this week, and we'll see you next time. Cheers.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the dead send back.